moment because there's also a DVD video accompaniment of this. All Apologies live at the Reading Festival in 1992.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And what an amazing concert. It featured the very infamous scene where Kurt Cobain came out in a wheelchair and the bathrobe. And it was just, it's so funny. And it's also, I think what I love about this set is that there is a legacy behind Nirvana and Cobain of this very tragic, dark figure. And yes, a lot of his songs were very dark, and he did, unfortunately, have a very tragic end. But what people always forget to mention is how funny Nirvana was and how much fun they had when they were performing. And at their best moments, how much life they bled into these songs and into their performances. And that's what I loved so much about this. And it's really cool, too, because this took place in a concert in 1992. So it's about a full year before the album version was ever released of what we heard from All Apologies, the song itself, which most people, I think, have heard it so much at this point. It's one of those songs to easily kind of sidestep because it feels like it's just ubiquitous at this point. But when you really manage to reevaluate the song, the melodies, the lyrics, there's a certain type of theme going on here where Cobain's kind of just in acceptance of things, and really with that poetic lyric ending the song, all we all know is all we are.
Yeah, all in all is all we are.
Yeah, all in all
kind
is
of
all
like
we are.
His mantra or something.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Just it's so incredible to hear that, and just really it's such a familiar song, and when you get back into it you realize, yeah, it's actually great, and there's a reason why Nirvana were so revered for what they were capable of saying and what they were performing. Of course, Nirvana were also trying to recapture their punk roots on this one, getting away from the commercial success and more of the crossover appeal of their previous album, Nevermind. And that really showed on this track that was almost considered a throwaway song, but was also arguably an immense fan favorite, Tourette's.
Yeah, featuring a lot of nonsensical words that are hard to decipher. Originally, it was called The Eagle Has Landed. Mm-hmm. I believe that's on the Muddy Banks of the Wishka CD. He talks about it. We heard a different version, the 2013 mix, which features some different guitar and I think vocal overdubs. Anyways, it's just a slightly different version coming from the 20th anniversary box set and the standalone 2013 mix that they released separately of In Utero. And then before that, we heard a live version of radio-friendly Unit Shifter from what many feel is one of the best recorded and performed live Nirvana concerts, in addition to Reading. They have quite a few, actually, but this is the Live and Loud from 1993, which for a really long time was just like a bootleg that you could find online. But then they released it officially as part of this set, and then again separately. We heard a live take of radio-friendly Unit Shifter, and at this point Nirvana was a four-piece.
That's right, because Pat Smear was part of the group, and you can really hear that, especially at the end of that particular track. And what's so great about this too, we did mention earlier that on this album there's a lot of addressing of fame and this sudden onset and burden of it that Nirvana felt, and this song definitely had to do with that, but was particularly sparked by a particular article, or was it an interview in Vogue?
It was either Vogue or Vanity Fair.
Oh, it was Vanity Fair.
They said some things about Courtney Love that weren't true, that really bothered Cobain, and he kind of wrote this song about it. It's about a lot of things, but that's kind of what inspired it. And originally, I think it was called 9-Month Media Blackout, because that's what he wanted to do when he read it. He wanted to just cut off all media talk for 9 months.
What's really interesting, too, which I do want to bring up, is that why I like these songs that address the trappings of fame that Nirvana experienced was that they didn't take on a woe-is-me approach, because you do have this sort of tendency for artists who suddenly blow up in popularity. They'll have the woe-is-me, it's so hard to be famous song, which is really condescending to hear. But then Nirvana's songs were different, because they actually took a lacerating look at the superficiality of pop culture, of just how damaging it was, not just to performers, but to audiences, to be a part of this whole zeitgeist. And that's why I appreciate that about this album, where it isn't just Cobain saying, oh, it's horrible to be famous and rich. No, he's saying it's horrible to be ingratiated in this system that treats people like objects and that just exploits you for money. And radio-friendly Unit Shifter definitely adds to that. We talked about a live performance from the band from Live and Loud in 1993, but for the longest time, the only commercially widely available live performance by the group was one that really stood out in their discography and was really unlike anything else you could expect at a Nirvana concert, and that was the infamous MTV Unplugged Live in New York. And there's no reason this album should have been as good as it was. It was an MTV commercial tie-in. It was a recorded live session that Nirvana, for all intents and purposes, could have just drifted through, and they did not need to put on the iconic performances they did. And yet, somehow, this stood the test of time, being one of the greatest live albums of all time, showing that the band were more than just feedback and loud rock, that they could actually perform these very somber, intimate songs. And what was great with this is that Cobain used this as a chance to just not perform big songs from Nirvana, but to actually highlight his influences, bringing in members of the Meat Puppets, covering a pair of their songs, covering Bowie and the Vaseline's as well.
Of course, yeah. Another great album and video, if you can find it. I'm sure you can now, but a really great performance. And then prior to that, we heard...
Well, we didn't even mention, though, the song that was featured from
Penny
that.
Penny Royalty.
Penny Royalty, which is a great version of that, which really feeds the... I think it meets the somber sort of feeling of that performance. Now, before that, as Dave, you were going to mention, we heard a demo version of the song Milk It.
Yeah, this was some demos they did in Rio de Janeiro when they were playing there. I believe it was it 93? It might have been 93. It could have been 92. I'm not 100%.
No, it was actually 93. That's right.
I think, yeah. Okay. And we heard a different version of Milk It, different lyrics, a little longer. And then we started off that set with Very Ape from the album proper, In Utero. Another really great song, a favorite of mine. I always loved that one.
Same here. We are celebrating 30 years of In Utero, arguably Nirvana's best record. I know I teeter between this because on one hand, I do understand the power of the songs on Nevermind, but at the same time, there's something about the sound of this record that really appeals to me, which is fitting because the band was really torn about the sound on this record to the point where there was a degree at which the band listened to the recordings that they did with Steve Albini of Big Black fame, who they approached because they wanted someone to be able to recapture that very raw punk sound of theirs, and they felt it was unreleasable.
Well, I think it was a back and forth between the label and them, because when they originally did it, they were like, this is good. But then they were like, we want to fix this, we want to fix that. And as we mentioned, Scott Litt did come in, who... I think he did Nevermind as well, right?
I think he did a little bit of work on that, but he was known as kind of being the alterno rock guy.
Yeah.
So he was coming in doing a lot. And, you know, it's interesting because eventually Albini capitulated. He just let the band mix it, even though there was some animosity between him and Nirvana for a few years afterwards, which was eventually reconciled, especially with the 20th anniversary edition, because then Albini worked with the band again for that mix. Something that should be mentioned in addition to everything else, when this album was originally released, it went to number one.
Yeah.
But Geffen Records was still disappointed because they felt it underperformed.
It debuted at number one on the Billboard 200 charts. I think that's pretty good.
It's pretty good, right? But then, you know, they still said, no, this is not what we wanted. It wasn't quite on the same scale as Nevermind. And, you know, some people were even writing off Nirvana to an extent. Pearl Jam technically was doing more commercially successful. They sold more units. And, you know, there was this sort of dismissal in a way that wouldn't actually be turned over until the next year. A lot of people would say that was prompted with Kurt Cobain's passing, his suicide. But I'd also argue it was just a difference between Nirvana as a critical versus a commercial success. Because critically, when you look at what came out with In Utero, the popular press seemed to have mixed feelings on it, but the underground press, praised it. They felt this was the best thing possible, and especially when Cobain and Nirvana were working with bands like Jesus Lizard, sharing that gnarly sound. It was really an epitome of what underground music was capable of. So we've talked a lot about this, and we talked about the importance of this record, but it also has a range of influences on a number of artists, even to this day. And I think what we're going to do now is we're going to select some covers of bands performing songs from In Utero and then talk a little bit about the legacy this album had influencing future musicians.
Yeah, and what we're going to start off next is back in 2013,
yes.
With the 20th anniversary, a series of Canadian artists covered the album and a couple of the B-sides and singles from that time period in full. And so we're going to play a bunch of tracks from that. It's called Milkin' It. And then we'll play a couple other covers as well. But these are going to be all Canadian covers.
Yeah, so this will be very interesting. It's going to range across different genres. But let's just get right to it. We're going to hear Breeze's version of Serve the Servants here on this 30th anniversary edition of In Utero and Revolution Rock.